are listening to the Anomaly Radio Network.
Everybody, this is Smiles Lewis and Craig York. Say it again, Craig York. And this is Precognitive Dissonance, live on Thursday nights at Boston, Texas, on your radio dial. Radio dial. This is web radio, folks. It's the future, but it may be about to end. Who knows? They're always trying to get rid of our free speech. We're going to be a little more parapolitical tonight, talking with our guest, Mac White, here on Precognitive Dissonance. It ain't over yet, folks. So, again, thanks for joining us this Thursday night here on Anomaly Radio, Precognitive Dissonance with Craig York and myself. And, well, a couple of weeks ago, we wanted to have our friend Mac White on the show, and he's here with us. Mac, are you with us?
Here I am.
Okay.
Miles, if you could turn my phones up just a hair.
Okay. Hopefully everybody's hearing each other just fine now. And it's the end of the cheesy intro. And again, this is Precognitive Dissonance on Anomaly Radio. We try to do this thing every Thursday night from 7 to 8. Central Standard Time. And for those of you who are familiar with the lineup at Anomaly Radio, you know that our guest tonight, Mac White, is my co-host on the Tuesday night show, PsyOp Radio. And, well, guys, y'all chat for a while. I'm going to try to get this audio sorted out.
Miles is messing with dials and levers. Anyway, we're starting to talk a little bit about Villain of the Mysteries, and your work has been sort of semi-familiar to me for a long time, Mac. I have a mini-comic that I picked up at Austin Books in the mid-80s that features what is still one of my all-time favorite strips, Chuck Carson, Ventriloquist Cowboy, meets Mescalita.
That is an old comic. You must have surreal Western comics.
That's I think
that
it's,
would be the one. Yes.
little green cover.
That's the one.
Yep.
Yes.
Turn back. And I was equally delighted to discover I don't know if it's new, but another Chuck Carson story on your website when I started perusing it a couple of weeks ago. I really enjoy your Western pages, Mac.
Well, thank you.
And especially the cowgirls. I didn't know that Yvonne DiCarlo had played cowgirl roles until fairly recently.
Yes.
And wow.
So a lot of this wild, weird West stuff is available over on bisonbill.com and, of course, Mac's main website, macwhite.com. Mac, I let you in on the secret. We talked about you behind your back when tonight we were first supposed to have you on. And, well.
Yeah, that was the night one of the nights I had to run up to Dallas starting in late April, and up until last week, I've had to make a number of trips up there due to my father's illness and then his death, and so there's been a lot going on, and I had to miss that show. I've had to miss a lot of things, but life is getting back to normal now, and it's good to be on the show.
Well, having gone through that about 5-6 years ago myself, that let me at least offer my condolences to you, Mac.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's one of those things that's a life-changing event. no doubt about it, the loss of a parent, doesn't matter how old you are, it's one of those things that changes you, and that you just never can be prepared for. As much as you think you're going to be ready for it, it's really tough. It's on so many levels.
Yeah. Well, Mac, it was really a pleasure, so to speak, and an honor doing the last PSYOP radio with you and getting to hear, you know, your thoughts on the passing of your father and your ability to talk about things that you hadn't really talked about publicly that go into these weird realms, and but also the other things that you shared that we can get into a little later this evening about recent synchronicities in your life, related to family and friends. And as I said, I'd like to get into that later, but just really like some of the things that we talked about again when that night was how perfect a guest you are for precognitive dissonance, in so much as you, in your comics, you deal with things that both seem at once like fantasy, the kinds of things people expect to see in comics, things, fantastic stories that have both mythic overtones, but also very fanciful, surrealist overtones, and yet you work in those areas that obviously we all have in common, or and each or greater or lesser degree. You and I have the parapolitical interest, and but I think we all share a lot of the interest for the kinds of Fortean and anomalous subject matter that you cover in your various works. And I remember, I think the first thing of yours I ever was consciously aware of was Stigmata Sunrise, which was an amazing series covered and carried in the local Austin American Spaceman.
Of some, all places, yeah.
Yeah, their little excellent insert.
Yeah.
And it had everything from black helicopters and conspiracy and mind control and...
Sophia, the goddess of wisdom, and alternate realities and so forth. But yeah, and references to Waco and... I packed a lot in there. I don't think that the American statesmen realized quite what they were getting into when they commissioned me to do that.
I don't think that they would carry that anymore.
No, as a matter of fact, after I had pushed the envelope for a few years, they just went ahead and just killed the entire comic strip section.
Yeah, it's, I remember, what is it, Extremes? Flirting with, for lack of a better term, underground comics. And it was one of those, I was surprised to see your work in there. I couldn't overcome my general disdain for the Statesman enough to pick it up regularly. what finally happened? Did they just call you in one day or give you a phone call and say,
what happened was that, as I say, I continued to push the envelope with these parapolitical themes, and occasionally I'd do some other kind of comic, you know, so they never quite knew what to expect, but they told me from the start that I could do just about anything I wanted to, that it could be as violent as I desired. Now, the only thing I had, you know, I needed to do was to avoid, the four-letter words and so forth. And
nudity?
Yeah, and nudity. Beyond that, I could do just about anything. Well, I did this strip for them during the Y2K period, and I took that as an opportunity to just improvise a story. I started it it was serialized on a week-to-week basis. This entertainment insert comes out weekly in the paper, and it's Thursday edition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, I'll just do a murder mystery starring my conspiracy researcher detective protagonist, who I had done a story using previously. And it was a story that was carried in the Statesman called Operation Blue Beam. And well, so I revived the character for this piece called The Millennium Murders. And my idea was that I didn't know what was going to happen with Y2K, but I would just improvise, and whatever happened or didn't would be my story. And, the climax was that, nothing really happened with Y2K. Planes didn't fall out of the sky and, all the rest. But I had worked the plot out in such a way that then I had this character who was describing why nothing happened, and he stated that basically Y2K was used as a cover in order to install a security system, a structure to lay the groundwork for something bigger that was coming up very soon. And then the moment he was about to describe what it was, he gets his brains blown out. And of course, I didn't know what it was exactly. I just knew that something was coming up. I couldn't look into the future, and see that it was going to be September 11, 2001, or what it was going to be, but I knew that something was coming because I could see clearly that they were using Y2K as an excuse to install all of these emergency control centers in cities across the nation, and I thought, how convenient. They're getting ready for something. And ever since Waco and Oklahoma City and what have you, that so many of us had been expecting something to happen, we just didn't know, what it was going to be, that it was going to happen on September 11th or the exact form it would take. But something was going to happen. Anyway, they said they got all these complaints from readers about the violence of that particular scene, this guy getting his brains blown out. But, I had drawn a similar scene in a surreal Western just a few years before, the one titled Rio Bardo, and they got a few letters. They thought it was funny. They printed the letters. But they thought that the controversy was great. In this case, they used that as an excuse to, lay the groundwork for, we're going to have to look at what you're, at your scripts first before you actually give us the artwork and we commit to publishing it. And then following that, after I did one or two more strips for them, and their editor got to the point where he really didn't want to take a chance on having any more loose cannon cartoonists in the paper anymore. And so they created a contract that no cartoonist, no creative person in their right mind would sign, because it would give the Cox Publications
retroactive.
Yeah.
Miles was telling me a little bit about that a couple of weeks ago.
I've recently discovered that this is I don't know how long this has been going on, but it's very common for contracts now to have this sort of, okay, by signing to do business with us and provide us content, you're giving us the right to that content in perpetuity and anything you've already done. And
that's right.
And
if I had signed that, I would have lost the rights not only to reproduce the comics, but to any of my characters, any of my stories. Cox Publications could have made a film out of, say, my Bison Bill Weird West characters, and I would have had nothing. And the contract stated that there would be nothing, no kind of compensation whatsoever. It was a means of basically just killing the comic section without actually coming out and saying, we're killing the comic section.
Well, and it's interesting to see that kind of reactionary element, maybe not necessarily rearing its head, but enjoying something of a resurgence, at least in that corner of the industry, because I know that since the 70s, really, there's been an increasing push in the mainstream comics world towards more creators' rights, towards genuine creator control over the content.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's true. It's just that in this particular instance, the Cox Publications doesn't operate that way. They want to own everything that goes into the paper, and they want to have the right to, this is also in the contract, to revise it in any way that they saw fit, change the wording to, and it was permanent. That was also stated in the contract. There was no time limit on it, no sunset. It would go on forever. And in any medium whatsoever, and Cox Publications it is a major cable television, the Discovery Channel, what have you.
All those newspaper outlets.
It's to say nothing in the newspapers, but it means that basically they would own anything that I would do for them from now into the future, but also anything I had ever done for them in the past. And it was meant to be unreasonable. It was meant to not only lock me out of ever contributing anything, but also it was a way of just getting rid of something that had become a bit of a problem for them, which was the comic section. None of the cartoonists, one or two stayed on to do a few things. Corey Coleman, I think, still does an occasional comic strip in there. But Sam Hurt, who in addition to being a cartoonist, is also a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at this thing and said, no way am I signing this. And it just, that was the purpose. There were two artists, myself and Chris Ware, that the editor of the paper, Rich Oppel or whatever his name is, didn't like. It was the political stuff that I was doing that he didn't like. And he just didn't understand Chris Ware.
That, having page through the statement on and off over the years, that comes as no great surprise. I remember hearing it being described as the realest statement back even before I moved to Austin in 88.
It was something of a fluke that I ever got this gig, and it was because it just came in under their radar. And the guy that was the art director there at the Statesman for that particular excellent, that's the name of the publication, XL Ant. Insert. He just had this idea, to get some cartoonists to do this, and it was so well received. And it just came in under the radar. They just never suspected that that the comics medium could be as subversive as it is. And I went into it, really, I fully expected them. When I did Stigmata Sunrise, I thought, I'm just going to do this thing and just see what happens. And I knew that eventually I was going to finally push the envelope so far because that they were going to, stop me. And I'm just surprised it went on as long as it did. But I did it because I thought, wow, I've got an audience here in the mainstream media, and I'm going to do with this whatever I can do it and see what I can get away with. And that's how it happened.
Well, Mac, that's not the only newspaper that you've had run-ins with here locally.
Yes.
When I was editor of Austin Paratimes, we were lucky enough to work with you and have you do several covers and interior artwork for different articles that you were writing. And the good old days. But the other rag around town, the Austin Chronicle, that's considered to be the local liberal rag. You had some run-ins with them, but that seems to have at least had some sort of closure with...
That did, yeah. There were several... those were different kinds of problems.
Yeah, completely different situation.
Where we really had the parting of ways with, that is, myself and the Chronicle for a period of time, was when the Austin Chronicle ran a review of my good friend, the late Jack Jackson's graphic novel, Lost Cause. Jack, who was, you know, created the first underground comic. It was legendary, not only as a cartoonist, but as a Texas historian. And when they ran this review that attacked not only his book, but attacked him personally as being a racist, which was unfathomable, because he just depicted the years of Reconstruction in Texas following the Civil War just the way it was. That was so outrageous and of course, by that time, I had already pretty much washed my hands of the Chronicle for various other personal reasons. Jack called me up. He was really upset. They had printed this thing. I hadn't even read it because I'd stopped reading the Chronicle. And he had written a rebuttal, and they wouldn't publish it. And so I put it on the Internet, and it led to the international comics community just rising up in arms and flooding the Chronicle with letters. And Gary Groth of the Comics Journal ran an interview with Jack that rebutted the Chronicle, and the Chronicle came out looking very stupid. But the Chronicle, it was a year ago this month, in fact, that Jack died, and you know, I was surprised when the Chronicle contacted me, asked me to contribute to a special issue in tribute to Jack, and asked me to do the cover, as well as to write something about Jack. And so, you know, they realized that they had made a mistake, and, you know, all is forgiven at this point with them.
And it's amazing to hear you say that it's almost a year ago now, because it seems like only last month. Miles was kind enough to point out the addresses for a lot of the archive pieces, the Groth interview, and I think probably the most unsettling thing about it for me was discovering that the guy who had written the original review, Michael Ventura,
yes,
was a writer that until recently I had held in some regard. I tended to like his letters at 3 a.m. column.
Mm-hmm.
And I read this, and then I read the subsequent rebuttals, and it was kind of like, well, you know, it's kind of like looking at a linoleum floor and only seeing the white tiles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more of a picture there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the utter lack of grace when his own factual errors were pointed out to him was just kind of like, jeez.
Yes, and the editor, Lewis Black's refusal to print a rebuttal was a big mistake. Because, you know, it's one thing to critique a work of art or literature as being bad, but when you smear somebody with that label racist, that has serious effects on a person's life. And in Jack's case, his career as a historian.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a serious failure of judgment on Lewis Black's part. And that's where the real problem, you know, I mean, the review itself was a problem. But to not allow Jack to, have his rebuttal published, and Jack, who had had a long association with the Chronicle, who thought they were his friends, who had done numerous covers for them. I think he did the cover for the first issue of the Chronicle. And it was just incredible. But, you know, it's water under the bridge now. And the good news is that, you know, this was a case where the readership and that larger comics audience out there worldwide, wouldn't let this thing stand. And so, you know, that's the good news. And that the Chronicle did make an apology of sorts, and they did a nice tribute for him.
And it's one of those, there's, I didn't know Jackson at all. I knew his work from a ways back, and it's one of those, I can't help but think that, you know, calling him a racist reveals a profound ignorance of his work.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself wondering if Lewis Black doesn't from time to time wish that he just made the call a month or two sooner.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. It was a mistake, and I believe he realizes that it was.
Well, folks, you're listening to Precognitive Dissonance on Anomaly Radio. Our guest is Mac White, comics artist, paralegal writer, and just all-around good guy. Mac, you know, we've talked a number of times, you and I, and of course Craig and I, have, in talking about you, have pointed out, as I said earlier, your proclivity for dealing with subjects ranging from the paranormal to the paranormal-political, and how you got into that vis-a-vis your father being a newspaper man and questioning authority, especially around the Kennedy assassination case.
Yeah.
But also your early age experiences of precognition and dreams.
Yeah.
And that's one of the other things I like about you. You remember your dreams enough to often write about them and in some cases record audio podcasts of them with your Dreamograph recorder.
Yes. This thing I attach to my head every night.
That's been one of my dreams since I was a wee little lad, was to create a dream recorder.
Uh-huh.
Direct cerebral interface is just around the corner, gentlemen.
Yeah. It may already be here, and they just haven't made it public yet.
Right.
Well, that's one of those things. I mean, when you talk about any kind of recording medium, you're basically talking about impressing on some physical object its response to a series of electrical impulses. And what's running through your brain is electrical impulses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, figuring out how that works holographically, and interesting things that have been learned recently about the way memory works. I'm trying to remember where I read or saw this, but I think it was on The Anomalous. They were talking about a fellow who has basically had a certain form of amnesia for most of his life, something like the last 50 years. And it was the result of the removal of his hippocampi in 1953. And it was apparently a fairly experimental procedure, but the surgeon was horrified to discover that what resulted was relief of the symptoms, but at the cost of the fellow's ability to retain memory. If you remember the movie Memento, same sort of thing. And the interesting thing is, there were instances where the man would remember details. His therapist, a woman who's worked with him for something like 40 years, one of the nurses mentioned her to the patient, and he responded, "You mean Suzanne?" Which is one of those instances where some part of his mind filed away her first name. You know, he remembered no other details of her, and in fact would have to essentially be reintroduced to her on a daily basis.
Dear God. I remember back in 1999-2000, there was two important consciousness discoveries, areas of research that were blowing my mind and that continue to blow my mind, and that is One, there was a research lab where they had wired up a rat that they'd been running through a maze, and they recorded its brainwave activity when it was sleeping and dreaming. And they said that when they monitored its dreaming, they could tell when it was dreaming about running the maze, but also where in the maze it was.
Oh, wow.
And the other big thing was what's been talked about is the next lie detector device, and that is this device that can detect brainwave activity that exhibits symptoms of, not symptoms, but characteristics of memory or non-memory. And so, in other words, they could flash an object on the screen in front of you or show you a photograph of a person. And if you've genuinely never seen that person, your brain your brainwave patterns will appear a certain way. But if you have seen that person, they will react another way that will give away the fact that you've seen this object or person or whatever. In other words, they can tell whether or not whether or not you remember something. And apparently, I mean, I guess people with biofeedback training might be able to train themselves to suppress that wave and the brainwave activity, but a lot of folks have worried about this being the new kind of lie detector test.
Pre-crime.
Yeah, thought crime, pre-crime.
Well, you know, the potential for abuse is so great there because, you know, well, I don't know. You know, asking me, you know, if you flash something on the screen that is supposed to tell me whether or not I committed a murder, well, it might only be, you know, my brainwave might be reacting that way because I might have fantasized about killing that person, or I might have, dreamed it.
Drawn pictures of it.
Yeah, drawn pictures.
Or daydreamed
of it.
About it.
Ooh.
Daydream, yeah.
I don't know. My
wife, bless her heart, you know, repeatedly, at least every couple of weeks, you know, alludes to wanting to kill her ex-son-in-law. And then she just kind of laughs it off, and it's kind of like, well, he is a pretty odious human being.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, this is being recorded. Yes. Well, that's one of the dangers of people who have precognitive visions or dreams is if they do what most would say is probably the right thing and come forward, if they actually think that there could be something to their vision, they're suspect number one.
That's right. You better be really
careful. That's happened a number of times.
It sure has, yeah.
And that devolves into the discussion of is there truly free will or is reality predetermined? I tend to think it's a mix.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things. In spite of the title of our show, precognition has always been one of the least interesting aspects of the paranormal because 9 chances out of 10, what you're going to, the future you're going to see, you may not be able to interpret sufficiently, and you're only going to be certain once the event has actually occurred.
That's right. Any dream I ever had that I was able to label as precognitive, I didn't know that it was precognitive until after the event had happened. So it was too late to, you know, to try to, you know, stop the murder. I've had, you know, dreams where something terrible happened in the dream to a friend of mine or something, and then I'd have to stop and think, well, now, wait a minute. Should I really get on the phone tomorrow and call up this person and tell them, don't make that trip? Because I don't have the batting average, you know,
yeah.
that I could confidently say that was precognitive because, you know, so... it's never done me any good. I couldn't win the lottery, you know.
Well, and that's what Craig was saying reminded me of remote viewing. And remote viewing seemingly can have usefulness even if the remote viewer never gets any feedback or the feedback is years later. And yet the people who are tasking them, you know, militarily speaking and intelligence community wise, you know, they would task these military remote viewers. I'm reading a local remote viewer, Round Rock remote viewing teacher, former military guy, Paul Smith's book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, and it's a really amazing chronicle of the history of the military's remote viewing program. And what they found, though, is that they did seemingly have operational success. I mean, there were people who were getting these weird, vague narratives, and it helped them make decisions or find downed planes and that sort of thing. But of course, at that point, they were already working on with people who were good at it, and that was kind of the thing: is you find people who are good at it, or you find a way to quickly and easily train people to be at a certain level. So they do have that track record, and I would say, you know, that's the your approach, Mac, is spot on. I mean, I think as much as I've been playing up, you know, the fact that you've had these dreams, and as much as I find that really amazing and interesting, you're right. I mean, I think part of the reason you've had success is not, and I say success in the sense that, obviously, it wasn't a success to dream about the president being shot. And,
yeah.
But what I mean is,
it depends on how you feel about Kennedy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm a lot more ambivalent about the man than I used to be. Let's put it that way. Sorry. Go ahead.
But there's, I was just going to say, I think those quote unquote successes are partly just simply the result of the fact that you're someone who does pay more attention than the average person. And so you've seemingly had more than the average number of experiences in that regard. So you fall in that middle area between, you know, a quote unquote psychic or a trained remote viewer and your average person who doesn't even have a clue about their own psychic life. So I just would commend you for paying attention to your psychic life.
Yeah, you know.
And drawing it, because I like how the way it influences that as well.
I would like to quiz Mac a little bit, because I have a sense that I've had precognitive dreams. And for a long time, I would have experiences where I would at first mistake it for deja vu, and then a moment later, I would go, no, this was a dream I had. And usually it's something fairly innocuous. I will be standing in a particular location, look up, and I'll see, you know, an object or a person or two people standing in relation to one another, and I'll go, I've already seen this. I've already been here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, is that how the experience comes across for you, or?
Yeah, that's a good question. Generally not. What will happen is that I will have a dream, and then the event will occur, and I'll think, wow, I already dreamed about this. I mean, it will not be it doesn't feel like deja vu, which is this momentary cognitive thing that happens. But I'll tell you this. There was a time about, 7 years ago, one summer, when I have gone through periods of time where for maybe 2 or 3 days, I will be throughout the day, something will happen. I'll see something, think something, do something. Somebody will say something, I'll hear it, whatever. And it will remind me for a split second of something that I dreamed the night before. And the incident that I'm, or series of incidents I'm about to describe, about 7 years ago, that summer, I had been up to visit a friend at his farm in North Texas, and I got bit by something. I didn't know what it was. It was at nighttime, and well, I come back to Austin, and but first let me back up and say, after I was bit by whatever it was, I put my hand against a tree at night, and I got two sharp bites on one of my fingers. And we didn't know what it was. We, you know, treated it the best we could. And when I went to sleep that night, I had the strangest dreams. It was psychedelic. And I got over the injury. But for the next week, every day, all day long, that feeling that, wait a minute, I dreamed this last night. But in addition to that, I was having... there would be these things that would happen, you know, dreams that I would remember. I'd wake up in the next morning, and wow, it would happen. Okay, so about three or four of these incidents. One of them was I dreamed that I was talking to my friend, the same one up in North Texas, and I was talking to him on the phone, and I said, I just heard on television that there's been an earthquake in California, and it was 6.5 on the Richter scale. So the next day I called him up, and I told him, I said, you know, ever since I came back from seeing you after that, whatever bit me, this has been happening, and I told him that dream. I said, and I dreamed last night that I was talking to you on the phone, and I told you, etc., 6.5 on the Richter scale. And there was long silence on the other end. And he said, you know what? I just heard on the radio a while ago that there was an earthquake in California, but I could swear that they said it was 6.6. And we thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. That was pretty close. Well, okay, you know, that was in the morning. The day passes. I go to work. I come back, and I find a voicemail message from him, and he's out of breath. I mean, he's almost hyperventilating, and he said, I just found out it was 6.5.
Oh, boy.
And that went on for about a week. I could, you know, spend a lot of time telling other incidents that happened that week. But then it began to fade away.
Mm-hmm.
But it was accompanied, the only time it's ever been, accompanied by this other thing that I experienced, which is this feeling throughout the day, you know, like for an instant. And then you try to get it back, you know, because it's deja vu. But you can't. You know, it's a slippery fish, that deja vu.
Wow. Anytime the subject ever comes up, I remember one of my favorite Woody Allen lines. Time is nature's way of keeping everything from happening at once.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And, you know, that in turn makes me think about the notion of God being omniscient.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and that's probably been the central problem with me and maintaining any kind of faith, is reconciling omniscience with free will. Yeah. If all knowledge of all time exists, you know, how can anything be unpredictable? Yeah. But yeah, anyway,
because all the subsystems in that hole are blocked most of the time to an ability even to perceive that massive amount of data. And should such an entity exist, I suspect it's not anything we can conceive of. That's why it's like, well, if there is some grand godlike entity or being or consciousness, I figure...
As a thought, man, dancing madly at the center of infinity with his demon piper surrounding him and smoking the really good stuff. for a while now, Nimrod.
Well, you know, there's this thing you hear that people have described for many, many years about near-death experiences, that they say your entire life flashes before your eyes. Now, that's a cliche, you think, but people say that really happens, and that in that moment of dying or nearly dying, I've heard this said so many times, and it's hard to grasp it, but everything you ever did, every thought you ever had, everything you ever experienced, and so forth, it all comes back in one instant. And what can that be but an experience that happens outside of time?
As he scratches his beard. Again, everybody, you're listening to Precognitive Dissonance with Craig York and Smiles Lewis, with our guest Mac White. Mac White, of course, being my co-host on the Tuesday night PSYOP radio on Anomaly Radio. You can find podcasts of this past shows of Precognitive Dissonance at precognitivedissonance.com. And guess what? Oh, you can find past episodes of PSYOP Radio at psyopradio.com.
A host of other wonderful shows on the Anomaly Radio Network.
So we're entering into the last 15 minutes here. Speaking of weird personal experiences and synchronicities, wanted to bring back up the subject that you brought up on the PSYOP radio last week.
Yes, because since that show a week ago tonight, I have got some more information from my sister about what I was describing, and I'll have to recap this for those who didn't hear that show.
Please.
It was Tuesday, the 29th, just a little over a week ago, that I went to Dallas for my father's funeral. And that day, a close friend of my sister's was about to give birth. This friend is named Sky, S-K-Y-E. Okay. She was at the hospital, and normally this was a situation where my sister Lavelle would have been there with her, but she couldn't because of our father's funeral. So after the funeral, we go back to my mother's house and so forth, and then myself and my daughter, we have to get back on the road and come back to Austin. And Lavelle had left shortly before us because she had to get over to the hospital there in Dallas to be with Sky, who was about to give birth. Well, about halfway through our journey back to Austin, we were passing through Temple, I recall, Lavelle called me on my cell phone. She said that Sky had given birth successfully. But here's what happened. Her husband had, right afterwards, called his father to tell him about the birth. Well, his father, just a few minutes before, about the time that the baby was being born, his father had just been in another room in the house and had seen his other son alive. This other son had a history of seizures, but there was no expectation at all that his life was in danger. So it was timed down almost to the minute that he gets the word over the phone that the baby's been born. He goes back into the room where he had just a few minutes before seen his other son alive, and he finds him dead. He's had a seizure, and he's dead. The young man had, I think, 18 years old, had died. No, 22 years old. had died at the about the same minute as this baby was being born. Now, here's what my sister sent me today in an email. She says, after the funeral of Skye's brother-in-law, the family was discussing what a coincidence it was that Skye's son was born while John was dying. The elderly grandmother spoke up and reminded everyone that the day this occurred was also the date of their grandfather's birth.
Oh, wow.
A grandfather who is now deceased. And he was the original John Bowman, the name of the boy who died.
Yeah.
He was named after his grandfather.
Oh, my God.
It gets even weirder. The mother of the recently deceased young John Bowman then remembered that the grandfather was alive all through the time she was pregnant with John, but died soon before he was born. Well, what on earth does that mean?
There, like I said before, there's a strange symmetry and resonance with that. It just, if,
and this is one of those, I'd have to have an annotated copy, but I'm pretty sure that Charles Fort mentions several instances of this. I have a notion that Lauren Coleman also touches on it in a couple of his works. And, yeah, odd synchronicities like that are always not exactly disturbing, but just interesting.
Right. In a way, they're reassuring. Because, now, just to digress for just a moment before I finish that thought, one thing that my sister mentioned here in her conversations with Skye is they're wondering about soul transference. I don't know. But who can answer that? But if you look at this strictly from the standpoint of synchronicity, and Jung's definition of synchronicity was meaningful coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
And bear in mind that there's a degree of synchronicity that's occurring on the day of my father's funeral.
Yeah.
And this being a close friend of my sister's. You know, in dealing with my father's death, I had dreams, which I described on the show last week, that were reassuring, that left me with a sense of peace, and that there was an afterlife, and or is an afterlife, and so forth. But then, you know, that feeling of peace begins to fade throughout the day, and then there's I struggle with doubt and don't know. But then when you encounter instances like this, these kinds of strange stories of synchronicity that are such extraordinary coincidences, then it seems to point towards a level of existence that, well, it just seems to underline the idea that what we see as reality here in this physical realm that we live on is just a small part of the whole, and that there is a spiritual level to existence, and that we, these finite lives that we live, are part of something eternal. And so that's why I suggest that synchronicities of this kind may serve no other purpose other than to reassure us that there is more, that every, or at least this, that every death is followed by another birth.
Absolutely, yeah. Or, you know, and in a very real sense, nothing and no one ever truly dies. I mean, we are made of matter, and that's, you know, I take an almost perverse comfort in, not exactly an anti-spiritual stance, but call it a scientific stance, if you will, that the simple notion that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. You know, what we are has always existed, and in some form always will.
I was thinking of, you know, when my mother was raising me and I was, you know, being inspired by the spiritualism, the animism behind movies like the Star Wars series, the idea of a force, she would describe, you know, that life is kind of, she said that she thought of life and the afterlife or the spiritual realm being like a bathtub full of water, and that each, you know, time you scoop up a bit of water in your hand, that's somebody, you know, who's incarnating, if you will, and then when you ultimately they go through the fingertips and they get poured back into the water. Or the image that I even like even better is of a stream or river in a raging waterfall, and those little droplets of water in the waterfall are people who are alive.
And you know, that reminds me of another image, you know, that parallels what you just said. And I first heard this from an individual who influenced me very greatly, and who also died over this past year. This was Raja Rao, the great Indian novelist who lived here in Austin until he died. He was in his 90s, I think, and I took a course in Buddhist philosophy with him at UT in 79. And one of the things he said, among so many beautiful things that really stuck, you know, in my mind, was he described how you know, this mass consciousness thing, not his words, but mine, but the image here is his, it's like an ocean. And, you know, but we are the waves on the ocean.
Hmm.
And you know,
The water goes deep.
And
we're just at the surface.
And having said that, I should then read the next paragraph here in my sister's email. She says here, as I told you earlier, Sky and Jason named their baby Ocean Jonathan Shane Bowman. Jason had had a dream a couple of years ago that he had a son named Ocean. So he insisted all during Sky's pregnancy that their son's name would be Ocean, much to Sky's dismay. Anyhow, Sky was still in the hospital during John's funeral service. She wasn't able to go because she'd had a C-section. But she says her husband was totally shocked during the service when the preacher quoted a scripture that mentioned the ocean. Even more bizarre, one of John's teachers wrote a poem and read it at the service that mentioned the ocean several times. This teacher did not even know about the birth of Sky and Jason's baby.
Well, it's touching and appropriate.
You know, that really does drive home the point you were making earlier about the reassuring quality of things like this, of synchronicities like this. And I didn't mean to come off as cold and detached earlier. To me, that viewpoint, I can't describe how tremendously liberating it is.
I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
The universe is one thing. And the universe doesn't stop being one thing because a part of it, a small part of it, meaning you or me or somebody else, you know, dies. You know, we're all just part of the universe. We're all part of this big thing. And it is the real thing. And we're just little parts of it. But just because those parts die, you know, doesn't mean that the whole dies. And it's the existence of the whole that truly matters.
Well, with that, I'd like, guess we can close out the show and say, Mac, we certainly, I loved having you on. I want to have you on again. And, of course, it's a pleasure to do the show every Tuesday with you. Craig, any final words?
Well, something I kind of wanted to touch on, but we can get to it another time, is that I'm always intrigued by what artists and writers read themselves. And the next time you're on, the next time we're all on together, I'd kind of like to know, you know, what does Mac White read when he sits down and when he goes out to buy a comic?
Okay.
All right. Well, Mac, everybody can go to MacWhite.com and BisonBill.com, and we'll have you back up soon. Thanks for being on the show, and let's go out with The Cure's The Same Deep Water As You.
Keep watching the seas.